Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Yesterday, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement effective at the end of next month. Kennedy's retirement will give President Donald Trump an opportunity to nominate another justice, one who probably comes with a conservative point of view. For most evangelical Christians, it's a dream come true, and one of the reasons evangelicals overwhelmingly support Trump, even though his personal life, behavior, and character do not seem to be what devout Christians would approve of. As our guest today has written, they are willing to look past his flaws because he brings what they want politically. Joining us is Dr. John Fia, author of the new book, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. Dr. Fia is also historian and professor, chair of the history department at Messiah College. Dr. Fia, welcome to the program.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so yesterday's announcement that Justice Kennedy and the subsequent reaction to it that he was retiring, President Trump will nominate a more conservative judge, is a perfect example of what you write about in your book, Why Evangelicals Support Trump Overwhelmingly. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, once the nominee is chosen and confirmed, that should be a pretty wild process, very contentious. The evangelical community, the conservative evangelicals, especially white conservative evangelicals, elected Donald Trump, to quote a biblical phrase, for such a time as this, right? I mean, this is the abortion, religious liberty are the two major issues. If evangelicals, conservative evangelicals in America had a kind of hierarchy of morals that they're going to vote on, it's those two issues. And, you know, we'd be kidding ourselves if we didn't think that these evangelicals were hoping that Roe v. Wade would now be overturned as a result of this. This is a dream they've had for the last 45 years. So evangelicals always will appeal to a political playbook that was really written by the leaders of the moral majority or the Christian right in the late 70s and the 1980s. That playbook essentially says, elect the right candidates who will appoint the right justices and confirm the right justices, and then we will be able to return or restore America to its moral or Christian roots that it was supposedly, at least, founded upon.
So what you're saying is that being able to appoint conservative justices, Roe v. Wade is one case. I'm sure same-sex mm-hmm. marriage is another, and we'll maybe talk about some others as well. But that this is the most important issue to evangelicals, at least the white Christian evangelicals?
I would say so. Abortion is certainly on the top of that list. All Christians, all evangelicals believe that life is important, right? But for over 40 years, conservative evangelicals have essentially argued, although they would never put it this way, that life issues for them, political life issues, end once the baby is born. They don't necessarily have a track record for supporting social policies that help life once human beings come into existence. So take the immigration case, for example, immigration controversy. Yes, conservative evangelicals would be upset that babies and children are being separated from their parents on the border, but that's never going to sway or force them to break from Donald Trump, because Donald Trump holds the right issues on abortion. And, you know, many conservative evangelicals have now come to grips with the fact that gay marriage is not going away. So they've shifted their view from an attack on gay marriage to a defense of what they would describe as religious liberty, right? The right to uphold traditional views of marriage and privilege those views and not be persecuted for them or not suffer for them. So those are the two fundamental issues, I think, that Trump, you know, forgive me for the pun, that trump all other issues for conservatives. Again, white conservative evangelicals. Evangelicalism is a big tent where there's a lot of different positions. But white conservative evangelicals, the 81% that supported Trump, this is their moment. Yeah.
You identify yourself as an evangelical, but mm-hmm. I don't know whether you're conservative or not, but from reading the book, you do not support many of the policies of the Trump administration.
Yeah. The book is interesting for me. I'm a traditional historian. My first five books that I wrote were pretty much straightforward history books. This is the first book, believe me, in which I actually got into some kind of cultural criticism, political opinion. So it's a little bit different for me. So I'm writing in some ways as a historian, trying to think about the historical forces at work that led evangelicals to turn to Trump. But I'm also writing as an evangelical, and I'm writing to my tribe. And I'm trying to get them to see that perhaps their overwhelming support of Donald Trump requires some degree of compromise and some degree of danger, if you will, to the ultimate mission of the evangelical religion, which is to proclaim what we evangelicals call the gospel, or the good news of Jesus Christ, the life-changing message that we believe that gospel offers people. So I think whenever evangelicals attach themselves to a political savior in the way that they have to Donald Trump, that can become dangerous for their witness in the world.
Some would see some inconsistencies in evangelicals, you know, anyone who's a devout Christian, and the president's background. There are times where I think that, and I've said this before, that in the past, any other president, any other political candidate, any other elected official who paid off a porn star, that would have been a game changer right there. That would have been the end of the line right there. I mean, we think back to 1984 with Gary Hart, an affair that wasn't even confirmed, and he had to resign, drop out of the race. But yet evangelicals look past this. And that's just one example. Yeah, yeah. There are many examples of the president not being very Christian-like.
Right. Well, you referenced Gary Hart. I would even push it even closer to the present and reference that some of those same evangelical leaders who said that in 1998, Bill Clinton, did not have the character to be president of the United States because of his affair with Monica Lewinsky. Some of these exact same people are the ones who are now saying, pushing the character issue to the side because Trump has the right policies. So I think going back to this political playbook, when the playbook was written by the moral majority, right, the attempt to sort of win the culture war through politics, it was always assumed that someone who believed in traditional moral values, as the evangelical right describes them, abortion, opposing gay marriage, and there are all kinds of other issues through the years, stem cell research and all these other things. One always assumed that a man, and in some ways it was always seemed to be a man, there's certain gender issues here, right? A man who upheld moral character would naturally support these kinds of issues. So there was a close connection between the political agenda, the policy agenda, and the character of the individual carrying it out. In 2016, that playbook was put to the test. Would the playbook, the policy agendas, survive if there was a man who did not exemplify that kind of character? And I think what we saw is that it did. The playbook survived.
Let's take a phone call from Bill in Lancaster. Bill, you're on the air.
Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
I'm doing well.
Listening to this, what it harkens to me is, it doesn't matter who does it so long as we get what we want, or the end justifies the means.
Dr. Fia, is that what's going on here?
Well, it's hard to, it's hard to tell, but certainly, Donald Trump is using the evangelical community. He needs their support. He needs their votes. He needed their votes in 2016. He needs their votes in 2020. He wants to hold that base. This is a, white evangelicals make up about 25% of the American population. On the other hand, white evangelicals are in some ways using Donald Trump to accomplish their agenda and trying to get that agenda at any cost. So this is, I agree, the end does justify the means. It doesn't matter about the character of the person or whether this person, this person's character violates everything that the Christian faith teaches. If we can get what we want, we will get into bed with this man.
Thank you.
I've always been taught by everybody the end never justifies the means, including in all the Christian teachings that I've ever heard.
Hey, Bill, thanks for your call. Dr. Fia, what about
Well, it's
that?
A lesson I think that evangelicals need to learn, conservative evangelicals, that, we'll see what happens. They may get what they want. I have no doubt, as you mentioned at the opening, Scott, that they're going to get their conservative justice. And the court will be changed. The court is already being changed. 20 years, 30 years, for a generation. Trump, this is going to be his major legacy, I think, if he can get this conservative justice nominated or confirmed. So my question as an evangelical, you asked me, I'm an evangelical myself, is, yes, we'll win the court, but what damage will this do to the moral authority, the moral clarity, the respectability, if you will, and the message of evangelicals in this world? How long will that damage, go on? It could be generations before evangelicals get any kind of significant voice again in the culture, or even in their faith-based witness.
Now, why do you say that when you're saying how will evangelicals get that? It seems as though if they get this conservative justice that, I saw on several social media posts yesterday from conservatives and evangelicals that we're winning so much. And they're quoting the president when he was a candidate. He'd say, you'll get tired of winning. That they see this as a game changer, that this is what they've wanted, and it's changing. So this could have repercussions. I'm not just talking about the judicial nomination, but this winning, the Trump administration, the legacy, could have repercussions two generations down the line.
Yeah, well, you need to understand at the core of what it means to be an evangelical, the word literally means good news. I've referenced that already. The gospel, right? And not to get too theological here, but evangelicals believe that, Jesus died for one's sins and can provide them with new meaning, new purpose in life and change their lives, right? That, to me, is a religious issue. That is at the heart of what evangelical faith is. There's nothing within evangelical faith or within the scriptures that talk about being part of one political party or another political party. Evangelicalism, Christianity, is a religion of self-sacrificial love. It's based upon an act of self-sacrificial love, Jesus on the cross. It's not a religion based upon the pursuit of political power. So I think anytime evangelicals hitch their wagon to a particular political party, and I would say the same thing about more progressive evangelicals attaching themselves to a progressive candidate, it's going to hurt the message. So think about it this way. There's an old Baptist saying, right? And I'll try to say this in a clean way since we're on the air. if you mix ice cream and horse manure, right? The horse manure is going to stay the same, but you better believe that ice cream is ruined forever. And I think that's one of the issues here, that, when the church gets involved in politics, it's only going to hurt the church. Politics will be fine, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today is John Fia, author of the new book, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump. Dr. Fia is also a historian and professor at Messiah College. John Fia will be at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg to launch the book this Saturday at 6 p.m., and that is free and open to the public if you'd like to come hear Dr. Fia speak about the book at that time. We're talking about the evangelical support of President Trump. trying to explain it? Give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so we've covered the reason that evangelicals support the president for the reason of nominating conservative justices, mm-hmm. making the courts, and not just the Supreme Court, but other federal courts as well. But what are some of the other reasons that evangelicals support President Trump?
Well, the big one I talk about in the book is there is a long history. I wrote a piece in The Atlantic earlier this week about this as well.
Yes, read that as well.
Evangelicals have a long history of fear. And what I mean by that is even many conservative evangelicals believe that the United States was founded as a Christian nation. It has the hand of God, in other words, on it. It's exceptional, not because it's a beacon of democracy, but because God has a plan for America as part of his divine will for the ages. So if you believe that the founding fathers of the United States created America to be a Christian nation, you are obviously then going to want to guard that nation. Evangelicals, for their entire history in America, have been the vanguards, if you will, the defenders of the idea that America is a Christian nation. So any time in American history that nation is threatened. So, for example, when Thomas Jefferson is elected president in 1800, he is a deist. He is not a Christian.
That godless Thomas Jefferson,
exactly.
As some people referred to him.
Yeah, and they were afraid of him. So let's do everything we can to stop him. Or when Catholics come into the country and threaten the Protestant identity of the nation in the 1840s and 50s, it's evangelicals leading the charge of this kind of nativism, right? This fear of Catholics. And you can trace this for over 300 years in America. And I think the response that the evangelicals have to Donald Trump is the latest manifestation of this fear. They feared the changes that took place, especially in the area of marriage under Barack Obama. And those changes happened very quickly for evangelicals. Obama, when he came into office, defended the Defense of Marriage Act. By the time he left, Obergefell versus Hodges had been passed legalizing gay marriage. Now, for the gay community, it's been a long journey, but for evangelicals, this happened very quickly. And it's another example of their Christian nation is eroding and they respond with anxiety and fear. Ironically, if you read the Bible talks about fear in two ways. One, the fear of God. But mostly the Bible talks about fearing not because you have God on your side, right? Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, Psalm 23. So it's this great irony that evangelicals who have these resources within them, their spiritual resources to be able to overcome fear with faith and hope, don't do that. So Trump to them is a sort of strong man, right? Strong men, political strong men calm the fears of their people. And Trump has become in many ways a savior then to these evangelicals who have put their hope and trust in Donald Trump to protect them from the forces of secularization that are eroding their Christian nation.
Okay, so just want to be clear on this.
Yeah.
It sounds as if what you're describing is that their faith has kind of been put on the back burner because they see Donald Trump as restoring, making America great again.
Yeah. I mean, think about the phrase make America great again, Scott. I mean, a lot of ordinary Americans may look at the word great. Right. Trump wants to make us great. I'm a historian. I tend to gravitate towards the word again. Right. So when was America great? Right. And many evangelicals have this sense of nostalgia, a sort of misplaced sense of nostalgia, that they want to somehow go back, return to a golden age. They're not really clear what that looks like, but there was a time when America was moral, was Christian, and so forth. But this kind of nostalgia can be a very narcissistic and self-centered way of engaging the past. You know, anyone who's nostalgic remembers, you know, all the good times, right? Things were good then, you know, and it may or may not necessarily have been that way, but that's how you remember it. So there's a lack of memory on the part of evangelicals that, you know, if the 1950s was when America was great, or the 19th century was when America was great, yeah, it was. It may have been a good time for sort of white evangelicals, but it fails to recognize that these eras were not necessarily great for a significant chunk of the American people, whether it be African Americans, whether it be women. So make America great again is certainly a phrase that evangelicals have jumped on to, right? But in some ways, it places a particular white Christian view of the nation over, you know, the kind of love of neighbor and concern about those who may have suffered during that period.
Let's take some phone calls. Susan is in Lancaster. Susan, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. This is very interesting. I see this at this point as the evangelicals trying to kind of legislate their values, okay? And, you know, you and I know both that everybody doesn't interpret a value exactly the same way.
Right.
I'd like to ask the professor, when does this legislation, quote-unquote, of values insidiously cross a line into religious tenets and compare and contrast this movement now and the very early seedlings of theocracies around the world, and what stopgaps are there in place? We all look at the Constitution, but still, if it's really insidious, how does this measure up to the very early growth of theocracies?
I'll take my answer off the air. All right, thank you, Susan, for your call.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. You know, certainly the founding fathers in the United States believed that religion, and particularly Christianity, because Christianity was the only game in town in the 18th century for the most part, you know, could serve in some ways the greater good of the republic. It taught people how to sacrifice their own interests for something greater than themselves. It provided a kind of sense of morality in the culture. You know, if you ask a conservative evangelical who supports Trump, they would quickly argue that we are not trying to create a theocracy. And, you know, I take them at their word. On the other hand, the idea inherent within some of the most ardent evangelical Trump supporters is a privileging of one religion over another, a privileging of Christianity, simply because there is a faulty historical belief that the founding fathers privileged Christianity over other religions, which they actually did not. There's a difference between saying Christianity or any religion for that matter is good if it teaches good public morality that's necessary for a republic to survive, versus privileging one religion over another. So I think that's what's happening. My big question is with conservative evangelicals, what happens when the proverbial dog catches the proverbial bus, right? What happens when they do control, or if they do control, all three branches of government? What do they want? Do they want to put abortion, women who have abortion, in jail? Do they want to require every town to have a Ten Commandments display prominently displayed in front of City Hall? The thing is, the evangelical Christian right has been so chasing this kind of sense of power and control over the culture, they've not spent a lot of time thinking deeply about what they will do if they ever get it. And there have been a lot of thoughtful evangelical Christians who have thought about, you know, how Christians can live together in a pluralistic society. But the Christian right is not listening to them.
A few emails here. Joy asks, don't the frequent lies from Donald Trump bother the evangelicals? Isn't truth-telling important?
Absolutely. And this is one of my strongest criticisms. I think last time I checked, the Washington Post had counted over 3,000-some-odd lies that Trump had told. But again, here's the rub. Here's the dare I say, the hypocrisy of it all, right? When you attach your entire expression of Christianity in public life to a political agenda and a president, then that means you cannot speak with any degree of moral authority to the lies, to the alleged adulterous affair with an adult film star, to the Access Hollywood tape, to the misogyny, to the bigotry. You know, so what you often see among Trump's staunchest evangelical supporters is when situations come up like separating families and children from their children from their parents at the border, you get silence, right? They suddenly are off their Twitter accounts, right? There's nothing to say because they really lose a lot of their moral authority in this process. And lying is just one example of that.
And you address this in the book. Jay in Felton asked this question or makes this observation. The Democratic nominee, and he's talking about Hillary Clinton, had an even more distasteful record. Also, there is no saint like a reformed sinner. I think Martin Luther said that.
Yeah.
But let's get back to what Jay mentions about Hillary Clinton, because you do address this in the book. And after Hillary Clinton, want to talk about Barack Obama, too.
Yeah.
But Hillary Clinton, many, as you point out in the book, many evangelicals looked at Trump and Clinton and said, Clinton, there's no way we can stomach this.
Right,
we'll go
right.
for the lesser of two evils in their minds.
Yeah, and I think Clinton was really, in many ways, because of her long history with the evangelical community since her husband was president and the whole Monica Lewinsky affair. I mean, I don't know. I can't think of any Democrat that Trump could have beaten, any other Democrat, because of this. I understand why an evangelical would pick Trump over Clinton. I think Clinton had some chances to appeal to the evangelical community. I mean, Barack Obama got 20-25% of the evangelical vote. I can't remember off the top of my head what the numbers was with Hillary, but it was much less.
Well, Trump got 81%, so it's at least 19% that she got.
Or the 19% could be people who just didn't vote for either of the candidates. So Hillary could have made some kind of an appeal to sort of progressive or moderate evangelicals and given them a reason to vote for her over Trump. And I think she failed to do that. She didn't even try to target evangelicals. What fascinates me, though, is less about why evangelicals voted for Trump over Hillary and more why they chose Donald Trump in the GOP primaries when there were clearly traditional kind of conservative Christian right candidates like Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Ben Carson, who were, and we can debate what character is, right? But were men of character, or at least closer to the kind of character the Christian right appreciates. But instead, they casted their vote with Trump. That to me is much more fascinating. Once Hillary was the nominee, it was clear which way evangelicals were going to go.
And there is the school of thought, which you address in the book, that what evangelicals wanted to do and the reason they didn't go for those other Republican candidates who probably would, on the surface, appear more attractive to evangelical voters, was they wanted to blow it up. I've heard conservatives say this, that we wanted someone in there who will criticize the media, mm-hmm. who will call people out. The president says isn't politically correct, but they wanted someone to blow up the system.
Well, these are the marks of these are the marks historically. Your previous caller asked about theocracy. I mean, there's a long history as well of the political strongman, the populist, who's going to rise up, protect you from whatever you're afraid of, and is going to go head on, if you will, and attack the institutions and the culture that is creating the environment in which you're afraid. And Donald Trump, evangelicals believe Donald Trump could do that better than, despite, Ted Cruz, who is also very much at play to evangelical fears. They believe Donald Trump would be more effective at doing this. Yeah.
Let's take a phone call from Frank in Honeybrook. Frank, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Great program.
Thank you.
I woke up last night around 3 o'clock worrying about the national debt. I'm a conservative liberal. And I believe in the Jefferson Bible. I don't know if
I've written about it.
I imagine he is.
Yeah.
And what I find is that many of the conservative Christian evangelical right are big on abortion, but they forget about the children once they're out of the womb. I find a lot of hypocrisy over there. Now, I was just wondering, the professor answered one of my questions, but if you didn't have Christianity, what would you base your moral values on? I remember that Bill Moyers had a great series on religion on PBS years ago, and I was just wondering what the professor's thoughts might be.
Thank you very much.
Well, I mean, I'm not a theologian or sort of a public theologian, but I will talk again about the Founding Fathers. I mean, the Founding Fathers did believe that they were creating a republic. And in a republic, there's a certain ethic that is necessary for a republic to survive. They learned these things from reading the Greeks and the Romans on these issues. And according to the Founding Fathers, there needs to be a certain moral ethic. We could call it civility. We could call it consideration of your fellow human being. Christians call it sort of loving your neighbor. But any kind of moral system, the Founding Fathers believed, that could contribute to what they would describe as a virtuous republic, a republic in which people are considering the needs of others at times over their own needs, would have been an adequate moral system for them to keep a republic in place. So certainly Thomas Jefferson, who cut all the supernatural parts out of the Bible, did believe that Jesus Christ and the ethics of Jesus in the Gospels were an ethic that was a perfectly fair ethic for thinking about how one relates to one another in a republic. So it doesn't, you know, you could find your ethical convictions to make the republic work. It doesn't have to come from evangelical Christianity or any form of Christianity for that matter. But I would argue in order for a republic to survive, and I'm with the Founding Fathers on this one, we need to practice some kind of moral code that forces us to live together amidst our deepest differences and to engage in civil conversation with those with whom we disagree.
Melissa in Chambersburg sends us an email saying, as a 27-year-old evangelical conservative, it is so refreshing to hear my thoughts voiced. I've struggled to understand how close family and friends can vote for and support Trump so adamantly when he's clearly not reflecting a Christ-like character. It not only seems many evangelicals are ignoring his character, but they're also going out of their way to defend it. I find it really disheartening. Now, you've kind of addressed this, but something that Melissa, mentioning her age, evangelicals, and she's 27, from polls, the way they vote, things like that, and not just evangelicals, but the younger generation, do not support many of the same issues. Look, they're not the same on abortion. That is not a blanket statement. It shouldn't be a blanket statement. But they don't have many of the same views as the older evangelicals on abortion, say the social issues, the culture issues.
Well, I think the younger evangelicals actually do tend to be conservative on abortion, but they see life issues as much broader than abortion. They're much more interested in social justice causes, the environment. The average Trump voter, and I'm not just talking about evangelicals, but the average Trump voter was 57 years old. Many of the evangelicals who voted for Donald Trump were products of the Christian right. They learned how to engage politically in the 80s, in the 70s. So I think you are going to see a sea change among evangelical social engagement. And in fact, I view this as a historian here in Central PA, like a kind of Pickett's charge, right? This is the last push of the old Christian right. And usually when you make a final push in a battle, you're throwing everything into it. And sometimes you may be successful for a moment in time. But eventually, I think with evangelicals, if I could go back on my metaphor here, is the the new generation is asking different questions. They're thinking about social issues in a very, very different way. And a lot of them are not operating on the political playbook that I talked about earlier in the interview.
Mm-hmm. 35 years ago, Ronald Reagan called the Soviet Union the evil empire. Trump doesn't criticize, and in fact, some would say he coddles Vladimir Putin. Even though the Russians meddled in the 2016 election, used military force in other countries, and make political opponents disappear. But there, that doesn't seem to bother evangelicals, which, you know, historically, traditionally, have been anti-Soviet, anti-communist, staunchly.
It's a major shift. And again, I think it goes to the weight and the power of this playbook. I think probably the most influential political figure in American life, and he doesn't get as much attention as he deserves in the history books, is Jerry Falwell Sr. He has managed to teach millions of evangelicals that there is only one way of engaging politics, and that is through these major issues we've talked about all this interview, abortion and other social issues, even to the point that you will overlook these questions of national security, these questions of Russia meddling in the democratic process, as long as you can get the right Supreme Court justices on the court, and you can end abortion, and you can defend religious liberty. Everything else is secondary. Mm.
Dr. Fee, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. So what's the future hold? I mean, you finished the book by talking about hope.
Yeah. I'm not a prophet. I'm a historian, right? I don't predict the future. But, you know, I'm really addressing the evangelical church. I think if evangelicals want to move forward, they need to replace fear with hope. They need to think more about political engagement in terms of humility and self-sacrifice rather than the pursuit of power. And I think they need to look deeply into the face of their own history and see that it has been white evangelicals that have been at the forefront of some of the most divisive moments in American history. And rather than looking back in with nostalgia at those eras, they need to look it in the eye and use the past and their own past, the dark sides, to move forward.
John Fea is author of the new book, Believe Me, The Evangelical Road to Donald Trump, and it is new. It just was published this week.
Today.
Oh,
yes.
So boy, history being made.
That's right.
But John Fea will be at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg to launch the book this Saturday at 6 p.m. Dr. Fea, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. 25-year-old Christy Mirak was murdered and sexually assaulted in her Lancaster County home in December 1992. The killing of the sixth-grade elementary school teacher got a lot of attention in Lancaster County and throughout the region. However, investigators were never able to solve the case. That is, until this week. Almost 26 years later, an arrest has been made using technology that may have never been used in a Pennsylvania homicide case. Joining us is Lancaster County District Attorney Craig Stedman. Craig Stedman, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So even though there was a lot of attention in the last few days, not everyone is familiar with this case. So if I could, take us back to December 1992. What happened at the home of Christy Mirak?
Sure. Before I do that, I just have to mention that this is a pending case and the defendant is charged and he is presumed innocent of all charges until we convict him in a court of law. And that's important to remember. So I'm talking about the case, the information, but we've got a process and a bigger, you know, bigger road ahead of us, and we need to make sure that his presumption of innocence cloaks him right now.
So, understood.
Going back to December of 1992, Christy Mirak was a sixth grade teacher. She lived in an apartment complex with a roommate. She was just living a normal life. She had her whole life ahead of her. It was getting close to Christmas. She had actually packages for her students, for each one of her students that she had prepared. And her roommate left for work early in the morning, a little bit later, she was about to go to work. We know that because she had her jacket and she had her gloves on when she was brutally attacked and sexually assaulted and strangled to death in her apartment. And it is a case that went unsolved up until this week. The family suffered not only the loss, but just not getting any answers, any direction. And we spent tremendous amount of law enforcement resources over the last 25-plus years trying to find who did this to her, because it's just absolutely horrific nightmare crime. And it was certainly haunting, you know, all of us in law enforcement. And the important thing for us was, you know, we never gave up. And we kept trying new things, and we had sort of run out of options, and that turned us into what led us to the arrest this week.
So the investigation up until this week, actually the last month and a half, and we'll talk about that next, but what did that investigation entail? I mean, when I say you, meaning law enforcement, interviewed over 1,000 people and rolled out a number of men who, I don't know if they were actually rose to the level of suspect, but I mean, talk about this investigation. It was big.
Yeah, I mean, it's taken up a considerable amount of space in my office just to have all these files. So you're talking about years and years of interviews. So you have a lot of people of interest, and since she didn't have any enemies. Who would want to murder this a truly innocent woman who's a school teacher? So we didn't have a lot of leads. So you just end up talking to, you know, what did she know this person? What about this? Was a relationship here? Anything there? And we just started using, in many of the cases, if there was a person of interest, we would try to use the same science that has led to the arrest, a use of DNA to clear person after person, because the killer, in this case, raped her, sexually assaulted her, and left, you know, his semen behind. So we had the DNA. So we knew if we could prove who raped her, that's the person that killed her. So we were able to compare DNA from the crime with any of these numerous people of interest and clear them based on that, in addition to the more traditional methods of alibi and just talking to other witnesses and things like that. But we just were running out of people to look at. And we did in the fall. We had one additional person of interest, and that person was cleared by DNA. So then, you know, we had reached out to Parabon Nanolabs to do genetic phenotyping, which is sort of a snapshot of what they think the person would have looked like based on ancestry and hair color and skin tone, and we did release that in the fall. Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is, what made you do that?
What made us do that was we didn't have any more people of interest. We had no more persons of interest that we were sort of at the end of the road, and this really, as I've said before, was the last shot we had, the last arrow in the quiver, and ultimately, you know, working with Parabon, it was really the best shot.
So they did come up with last fall. They did come up with a couple different pictures of what a suspect may look like, but then last month they came back with some other information that directly led to the arrest. Tell us about that.
Right. So in May, so we had the relationship with Parabon, and we got a lot of tips and appreciate all that. But in May, we were in contact with them, and they said, look, we're going to offer a new service, which is the genetic genealogy. You've heard about it, like with the Golden State case. And they said, we have an opportunity. We can do that for your case if you want to sign up with us to try that. And I jumped on it, and they came back pretty quickly with, and in that, what they do is they're looking at public databases, people, you know, ancestry type sites. They upload the DNA profile from the crime scene. So we gave them an extract from the carpet that had been from the crime scene. They put that data into to the genetic comparison to see if there's anybody closely related, and it's all public information. And they came back and told us, look, there's a close relative of the killer that matches this. And then through some of their genealogy combined with the genetics, they actually were able to point us to the defendant.
So basically, a relative and the defendant, the man arrested, Raymond Rowe, a relative of his had gone to one of these ancestry sites like Ancestry.com, 23andMe, you know, something similar, and for genealogy reasons had submitted their DNA?
Correct. And so they are looking for relatives or genealogy as a type of people. So they actually want the information to be public because they're looking for things, you know, links to them and their history. And so, yes, they came back and said, look, somebody that's done that is closely related to a suspect, and they were able to narrow down the people that would have been of the right age that would even fit that. Now, we don't arrest based on what Parabon did. So they gave us a name, which of not the entire country, so they could have found anybody, but they pointed to Raymond Rowe, who lived just a few miles from the killer. So they didn't find somebody in Idaho or Texas or anything like that. It was right here and right near her and of the right age. But we in order to arrest, we can't go on what Parabon did. That's a great tip, a scientific tip, but we needed to get his DNA to confirm it, to match it with the crime scene. And we had some great work by the Pennsylvania State Police. Some undercover troopers were able to get his DNA from an event he was at and from an abandoned item that he had left behind at an event. And we got the results that we did, which are pretty astronomical statistics based on the DNA.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you, Mr. Stedman, that number.
Well, look, I had to look up the numbers. So there's different numbers. There's a number of swabs that were taken from the crime scene and from her person. She was there were swabs taken from the vagina. There were anal swabs from her legs, and some of them are a little bit different. But the numbers that we're talking about, they came back and said the probability of randomly selecting an unrelated individual with the same DNA is 1 in 200 octillion for the Caucasian population, and octillion is 1,000 trillion trillion. I had to look it up. I never even heard that word. That's 27 zeros. Then there's other numbers that they use, like nonillion, which is 30 zeros, 1 in septillion, which is 24 zeros. It's the numbers are staggering. I mean, of course, there's 7.6 billion on the whole Earth, so those kind of numbers we're pleased to see.
But the investigation continues. You just can't rely, at least this is me talking here, I'm assuming that you just can't rely on this number, even though that alone, in many people's minds, would be enough to be to convict. You have to continue this investigation. What are you looking to do? What can you tell us, anyway, what you're looking
for?
Sure.
No, it's important, and that's one of the reasons, you know, I appreciate you talking to me today, is we are looking for information. You know, we did not have this defendant on our radar connected to her. There's some connection to her, and if there's somebody that has information about him or her that would provide a link between the two, we'd like to hear from them, or anything about him that we should know. There, you know, we're just now kind of beginning. That's what people were saying. Hey, that's great job, and all this. And it, you know, it's an amazing, groundbreaking use of science in law enforcement. That's tremendous. But we've got a lot more to do. And you correctly point out that it's the beginning. We're looking for more information. We are building even more. We're in a lot better shape than we were on Monday. I can't talk about the specifics, but I have a feeling it'll get stronger. It's just we need help from the public, and you do need the boots on the ground, the same old traditional ways of talking to people. And that's why this is a nice mix of determined investigators with science leading to, you know, the arrest so far. But we've got to make sure that he's held fully accountable by jury.
We only have about 90 seconds left. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Some have already raised privacy concerns about using DNA submitted by a relative or using it in this way. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that this is something that will come up. What do you say to that?
Well, some of it, I think, is based on misunderstandings. And this is not these are all people that have put – it's all in public. They voluntarily agreed to have it. In fact, that's the whole point of these ancestry things for those individuals, is they want it. So we're uploading it. Law enforcement isn't doing it. There's no violation of any privacy. And quite frankly, I just have to, when we talk about this, you know, whose privacy was violated was Kristi Mirax. I mean, not just her privacy, but her whole life was taken from her. So you have to have that whole broad conversation. But no, I'm comfortable with it. I understand the concerns. I think if people read more about it, Parabon on their website has some more detailed information that we can do in 90 seconds. But these are public. This is public information.
In 30 seconds, is this the first time that this technology has been used in Pennsylvania to solve a homicide?
It is the first time, and it's only the third or fourth in the country. And so this is truly groundbreaking.
You think it will be used more?
Yes, it should be. And with this success, I know I've had other DAs call me and see, you know, what to do. And I really, you know, we're certainly looking at, for all our cases, you have to have DNA. You know, it has to be, we have to have the science left behind from the crime scene or from the victim. But for those cases, you know, it provides a hope. And in this particular case, we were out of options, and it led to this arrest. So we got more to do, but it certainly is amazing so far.
Lancaster County District Attorney Craig Stedman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we have a full hour coming up on tomorrow's show. But the headliner is Super Bowl Most Valuable Player Nick Foles. He's just released a book that was published this week. He will join us on the program tomorrow. He also will be appearing at Midtown Scholar Bookstore tomorrow afternoon. So we'll have an opportunity to talk to Nick Foles of the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles. Also, we'll be talking with a law professor about Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy and his retirement, what to look forward to there. And thirdly, we'll be talking about poison hemlock, plant you probably heard a little bit about over the last few weeks. That's all coming up on the Friday edition of Smart Talk, so be sure to tune in.